Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo, beautiful people.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
Gentlemen, I want to direct your attention right away to an article that appeared in Boing Boing, which I think we've all had some fun interactions with those folks there. In some ways, they're kind of like a mirror universe version of us, more successful and, you know.
Attractive. Yeah, taller. Yeah. They can bench press more.
You know, more professional respect and prestige.
They're popular and they're wildly popular.
Yeah.
Really, it's a funhouse mirror. I mean, like if they woke up and saw themselves as us, they would blanch and recoil.
Yeah. True that. It's like in the movie Mask, not the one like with Eric.
Yeah, sure. The one where he has the messed up face and he looks in the funhouse mirror and sees himself as a normal person.
That's what we see when we look at them.
By the way, that's all terribly offensive language I just used. A normal person. There is no such thing as normal.
Yeah, normie. So there was an article, very interesting. They had an essay, if you will, by I will go ahead and call him a grandmaster of science fiction, Kim Stanley Robinson, who Brian is big fan of.
Yeah, you know, I love me some Kim Stanley Robinson.
Well, Mr. Robinson, if I may, and I just Eddie
Here's
Murphy's
to text. You, Kim Stanley Robinson.
Here's to you, Mr. Robinson. has a title of this essay is Our Generation Ships Will Sink, and goes on to explain basically the premise is we're stuck on Earth, folks, whether you like it or not, that we're not going to be able to – all the problems are in trying to go out to other – trying to colonize other planets, all the reasons why this won't work, and breaks it down into a variety of categories he describes as physical, biological, ecological, sociological, and psychological, which, I mean, gosh. I mean, that looks like three categories, but he gets put those into five, so he gets smarter than I am. And goes through a litany of all the problems from these and gets into just a number of the biological reasons and all that. I highly recommend you read it. I highly recommend you check it out and read his arguments to what this is. And basically, to sum it up, and probably not doing it justice to his points of view, though, is he gets into just all the physical problems when you want to take like humans and try and put them elsewhere. And then he gets into, you know, what happens when you're on these spaceships for extremely long times. Blah, 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 et cetera. And again, highly check it out. Go read it. But I say nay.
Well, by the way, spoiler alert. That and I didn't mention it before because Aurora, his latest book, was my pick before. But I didn't want to talk about any of the plot points. That's pretty much the thesis of Aurora. He details in great compelling detail all the reasons why stuff might not work. And in fact, at one point, there's a discussion about what he clearly finds to be a horrific idea, that there's a faction on Earth that just wants to keep on sending out arcs, figuring like we're dandelion seeds. Like, yeah, 99.99% of all of them, we're sending them to their death. But you never know, that 0.001% can you know, take root and make something happen. And it's clearly I don't know. I don't want to say like he's preaching or anything, but it's clear to the main characters that it's a grotesque idea for Earth to sit there on its mountain sending people to their doom.
So, all right. Well, then where are you at on this, Bri? Your boy KSR is out here talking about how we're never going to leave Earth. You know, I thought you were on cool guy, we're going to live forever on different planets crew. We all have our airbrushed jackets with a rocket on it. Where are you at?
I'm firmly in the camp of too dumb to know whether it'll work or not. But I mean, I do think we're going to leave. He ain't saying we ain't going to leave. He's saying we're going to leave a lot and it ain't going to work out so well.
I read this and I read it a couple times and then I did some research on stuff and I felt like I was being yelled at by somebody from the 1970s. in that well, this thing won't work and this thing won't work. Like, yeah, I've never been a Generation Ship fan. Never been a Generation Ship. And I'm not a guy that thinks that we're going to develop warp drive either. But there are many, many other different scenarios that he kind of doesn't acknowledge. And I have a couple little nitpicks with his. He starts off, he just sort of hand waves away Mars. And let me find the...
With good reason, because there's the... And we've talked about it before. What is it in the soil that means, like, it's just impossible to scrub out?
So
and they'll be able to use it?
His quote is... For some people, he says, hey, this can't be done. Oh, no. For some, this is a disturbing and deeply pessimistic conclusion to come to. Then when you combine that new judgment with the recently discovered problems concerning the plan to terraform and inhabit Mars, presence of percolates and absence of nitrogen, and we come to entirely new realization about our species that there is no planet B. Okay. Let's back that up. We'll talk about percolates in a second.
Just to lay down a base coat, before we get too far into this, when we talk about generation ships, right? When we talk about like what that is, just you know, not for me because I understand.
Let's explain it for all the dummies out there. Let's get to that in a second. Let's start with this first. Him saying, you know, we ain't going to colonize Mars because it's not hospitable life, and he says because there's percolates, which is true, and he says an absence of nitrogen, which was interesting to me because. The latest research says that, you know, not only – now we know there's nitrogen in the atmosphere, but that's not what we call fixed nitrogen, which means that nitrogen gas is not biologically available unless you do some sort of process, which actually we did invent a process for that, which is, you know, underlines how agriculture works today. But we did find fixed nitrogen in the soil. There actually is nitrogen in the soil that could be used for crops. It could be used for this. So he says an absence of nitrogen, but – that's not consistent with what the latest science is. So I'm already like, okay, this guy has an argument, and he's like, this is why we can't go there. There's no nitrogen. But well, wait, there is. Now, I don't know the degree or the amount, but we do know there's nitrogen and the right kind, the fixed kind of nitrogen.
Well, now, okay, well, there's two different questions. The question between colonizing versus terraforming, I think, are two very, very different questions. I think there's no doubt we can colonize Mars. We can dig out holes and we can live there and keep stuff relatively clean. And it'd be nice because it would be easier to live on Mars than it would be, you know, in free space because you'd have gravity and you'd be able to, you know, if you dig down, you could shield yourself from radiation and you could import, you know, good old fashioned American soil. But terraforming Mars, from what I understand, the perchlorates are very difficult to fix. Oh, all right, go for it.
We're getting to that.
All right.
First, the nitrogen. Okay. So he starts off with an argument and says there's an absence of nitrogen, and that's not consistent with what we know now. Now, he may have an idea of how much nitrogen he needs, he thinks there has to be for it to be workable. But when I start reading something that's criticizing, we can't do it because of this, and this one thing, like, no, that's not the current state of science, I realize, oh, this is a polemic. This is not, you know, this is a guy making a polemic. Why we can't, subtext, why we shouldn't.
No, not fair. Blowing a whistle. That's not fair to make up what you think he secretly means underneath.
He's pretty open about what he means if you read his research paper.
Unless he says we shouldn't, then I'm not gonna ding him on saying we shouldn't.
I'm free to argue what I think the subtext is, and I think that when you create a straw man like that, it seems to serve a purpose which would tend to support his other points of view and things on do that. Okay. My point of view. That's all. My point is that he makes a statement about that, which is not consistent with what we know. He says, here's the state of science, here's this thing. Look, wait, why, what, again, obviously I'm trying to interpret this, but that's my interpretation of it. Percolates are basically
Is it percolates or perchlorates?
Perchlorates, pardon me. Perchlorates are these little salt-like dust type things that get into your bloodstream and affect your thyroid and can poison you. It's one of the leaps we had to make in, you know, watching the movie or reading the book The Martian, is that he probably would have died 2 weeks in from all that dust he was breathing in. And it's a very, very serious problem because the amount of perchlorates that are on Mars, when you reach above, you know, 1% or so in the, you know, in your environment and you breathe this in, your body starts to shut down. And if you're walking around and you have spacesuits and you're going into your habitat and all this, these things are extremely, extremely dangerous. These things are absolutely something that we're going to have to watch out for and figure out. How do you deal with this? Well, a lot of brilliant people have been dealing with this. You know, once we realized perchlorates were a problem, have been trying to come up with solutions. We don't know that these solutions will work. We don't know that any of this will work, but there are solutions to it. But there's also an advantage to perchlorates, and that is that if you break them down, you actually get oxygen. You know, 60 kilograms of it gives you a day's worth of oxygen, and you can make a very simple thing, you know, system to pull oxygen out of there, to pull fuel out of there. And there's a research paper that goes specifically into that. That's called a perchlorate on Mars, a chemical hazard and resource for humans, which explains all the problems with it, why it's biologically hazardous to us, but then goes into like, well, here's the biological processes you can use to break it down. This is the bacterium. There's 50 species of bacteria that love perchlorates. And so there's ways in which you can all of a sudden turn this, which is one harmful, into something that is helpful. And if you're looking to the longer term thing that you talked about, Brian, difference between colonizing and terraforming, it becomes an advantage towards that. Nobody's going to be walking out on the surface of Mars for a century. But if you have these biologically available materials, they're there, that it increases your chances of doing that.
Yeah, and I think actually you make an extremely good point in that the big mistake Kim Stanley Robinson is making is that I do understand that there are big hurdles that are not popularly understood or in the popular consciousness at all. And I think it's smart, you know, wise of him to bring them up. But I completely agree with you in that he's placed himself in the unfortunate position of arguing against mankind's intelligence 100 years from now. And it's like, if there's one thing I know, is that you don't bet against mankind, and especially you don't bet against mankind's intelligence 100 years from now.
Yeah, and man, we don't know. I mean, there may be other problems, and I'm one of these people who talks about radiation. I'm one of these people that said that Mars 1 was a horrible idea because they just hadn't thought it through and all that. And I'm not saying, hey, it's a cakewalk, guys, and things we may think happen will happen in 10 years might take 100 or 1,000. And I want to take us back 25,000 years ago to a cave in Greece, Theoptera Caves, or Theopetra Cave. Theopetra Cave is like the oldest cave where we found something very interesting there. This is 25,000 years ago, 23,000 years ago. It's the middle of the Ice Age. It's starting to get – it's very cold. People have been living in these caves for 100,000 years or more, Neanderthals before then, an extremely inhospitable environment as it starts to get colder, we found something very special on the outside of the cave. And that's a wall. It's the oldest human-made, could have been Neanderthal, but the oldest, you know, hominid-made structure we found. They built a wall to modify their environment to block the wind. And that's significant because up until then, there had been hominids for a million years. There had been Homo sapiens. There had been Neanderthals in Europe for 500,000 years that just sort of accepted the environment as it was. This is the way things were. It gets cold. Cold winds are blowing through there. And these people said, you know what? What if we blocked the wind?
Well, and it sounds like, you know, that's kind of an eye-rollingly obvious thing to figure out. But I just reread How to Fly a Horse by Kevin Ashton, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's so good. And one of the things he talks about is the fact that for 100,000 years, we carved out the same hand axe by rote instinct, as if we're birds making a nest without ever thinking of it. And then there was a fundamental shift the day one human being, biologically identical to us, just one day looked and says, I can make this better. That leap from nothing to something is utterly staggering, and it's what's led to, you know, the creative avalanche ever since then.
Just a beep, bop, boop, iPod.
Yeah. Hop, skip, and a jump.
you look at a timeline, but Justin, you bring up a very interesting point, is you look at a timeline of how slowly things changed and then how quickly we went from, let's change the shape of this hand axe, let's change the shape of this, to all of a sudden – now, here we are in 2015, our International Space Station has been continuously inhabited for 15 years.
That's pretty rad. That's pretty huge.
It's amazing. Now, granted, it needs a constant influx of supplies to keep that thing going. I mean, it's not self-sustaining in any sense of the word, the amount of energy and resources it takes to do that. But there is a curve there. It may be a 20-year curve, it may be a 1,000-year curve. And Robinson makes some points about, like, hey, you know, to have an ecosystem, to have your Earth's not even a closed ecosystem, which is true, but our radical involvement of developing biotech and other things mean that, you know, we're learning things, and we're not going to have perfection. We're not going to have perfect systems, but we've been able to expand beyond our Earth's orbit now for or within Earth's or off the surface of the Earth for 15 years. Mm-hmm. We're going to be in, you know, we're probably within the next 50 years, we're going to be sustaining systems around Mars. We're going to be sustaining systems probably on asteroids. And my argument is that it's not like we just go from Earth and we put generation ships and we send them to far off systems. Is we go, we leapfrog from one point to the next. And there are so many, as I've called them before, hard bodies. There's so many surfaces between here and the next star system to inhabit that it doesn't mean that we have to go from here to the next planet. Is that we can hollow out asteroids. We can take asteroids and spin them around and build these sort of gravity systems that have gravity. There are a lot of places that we can go before we even try to get to another thing. And it's not like we have this example of we think of like these people, 20,000 years ago building a boat and like, all right, well, let's go colonize America. Well, no, let's go step by step by step by step. And there's so many there's more surface area outside of what's on planets than there is on planets and ways to have gravity, et cetera, like that. So I just, again, my whole thing with his argument was like, yeah, it's like a 1970s sort of point of view of.
Well, let's wrap up the Mars thing before we go on to the generation chips, because I would like to talk about that because he has kind of a different take on that. Justin, what's the verdict? What's the verdict from the outside? Mars tomorrow, Mars 1,000 years from now, or Mars never?
Well, I mean, and my thought with all of this is, similar to what you said, Brian, where it's like, I'm sure that there were a lot of people that had, based on all available evidence, a lot of very realistic, by the numbers, understanding of what they thought the New World was before, Western European, colonization happened, right? That, like, I think that if there's one thing that we know is that the closer we get to problems, the more we understand them, and very often the more that advancement depends on us pivoting our understanding of what something is and applying what is true versus what we've learned, and so it's like it seems odd to me that we just kind of put the brakes on, like, well, anyway, Mars, whatever, like that happens now. Like, I feel like the more we understand Mars, the more that we send, a manned mission there or further, robot exploration, the more that we gather, like, then we will understand the problems far more than we do now, in comparison to, like, what Andrew was saying. Listen, if there's still reasonable educated minds that are like, okay, well, this, perchlorates are our death, or they're, our fuel, to spend time there, like, then, who knows? I mean, like, I don't know enough to say that's, that's not right. I don't know enough to say that's right way to go.
You brought up a very good point, too, which was if you look back when at the birth of the United States and the problem with trying to split off from England as a colony is that there was this question of, are we self-sufficient enough? Do we have enough resources here? And that seems like a weird thing to be asking here in 2015. But there was a time when, the first colonies, Jamestown, et cetera, the only way they were to survive was getting iron and other materials from Europe. And then when we had, chemicals for textiles and other things and seed stocks and stuff, the idea that we would try to, they would have some sort of ability to be self-sustaining seemed ludicrous, because this was a continent that had been inhabited for 20,000 years, but the people had, apparently barely been able to, rise above a Neolithic existence and to have what we considered the modern European, contrivances or the modern luxuries seemed like it would never happen. And now you look at how, America has become a leading industrial power and one of the biggest producers of machines and tools and everything for the rest of the world. That changed.
So here's an interesting question, and I don't really have a dog in this fight either way. I don't have an opinion, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. That's a case where you have, we'll say in the geologic genetics, basically, you have virtually identical spaces in the New World and in the Old World, chemically, atmospherically, zoologically, botanically, virtually identical, and now we're looking at a substantial difference to Mars. And now I agree with you that it's a big difference, but you know, who knows what we'll be able to do either, you know, 100 years or 1,000 years from now. Here's the question. Is there an environment that's too far that you throw your hands up and say mankind will never be able to tackle that? Like colonizing Venus. Is that so far? Like, is there anything that makes you flinch and say like, no, that'll never, ever happen?
Well, you know, I guess that gets into sort of another aspect of what, you know, his argument was, is that he kind of talked about Homo sapien and not Homo sapien plus.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that, you know, we have in sci-fi these weird, bizarre examples of like, oh, I'm going to have four arms and this or whatever. But I look at it more as biotech develops and nanotech develops, and not as fast as we probably think it will happen, but as these things progress and we're able to hack our immune systems and our biological systems, a lot of things become possible. You know, when we think about the idea of the body of just being a thing that protects the consciousness, what does that mean? I mean, you know, Venus is, you know, ridiculously hot. You know, I mean, it is stupendously hot. You're trying to colonize there is, you know, effectively, you know.
Well, and that's the thing is, because what it gets down to is it's not a question of whether or not it's possible. The question is whether or not it's profitable. And it will very likely never, ever be profitable to try to terraform or colonize Venus.
Yeah, I can't see in the world that which we can understand or sort of think that we see beyond the horizon where that's practical. But, you know, talking to those people in Theopetra Cave and trying to explain what we're doing now, where we live, what we live in, you know, is utterly alien, an utterly alien concept to them.
So let's do this. And by the way, spoiler alert, the answer I think to all of this is that mankind ain't going anywhere. It's mankind's children in the form of conscious carrying robots that will expand throughout the universe. But let's talk about the generational shifts and whether or not and the problems inherent in that.
Mm-hmm. I think generation shifts are a dumb idea.
Let's explain. I mean, I understand, but just for anybody who doesn't, can we again just get an explanation, Brian, of what a generation is?
It's space arcs. It's you build yourself a 3 mile long tube that spins around about the size of Manhattan Island, or you, in the case of Aurora, you get yourself a double ringed, segmented, spinning. Looks like the space station from 2001 spinning with an ion drive. It's going to take 3 or 4 generations. You know, it spends half its time accelerating up, you know, at close to a G, and then the rest of the time spinning around and decelerating at about a G, so that your great, 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 great grandchildren will be the ones to colonize another world when you get down there. Is that about right?
Yeah. To me, it's an old idea that just, it belongs in the middle of the 20th century. It's not how we would get there, what we would do. That's my opinion.
You think what, we would hypersleep it?
I think that by the time we're looking to try to get to other star systems and stuff like that, why send all that matter? You know, send a 2 meter long probe that can build an antenna array and some nanobots on there, and then just transmit copies of ourselves or whatever. Teleportation's the future of it, you know, or a form, facsimiles or whatever you want to call it. That's how we're going to get there.
So,
you know, we're going to.
Okay, so you know, just so we understand, right? The idea is that we are going to far flung other star systems, right? And that's what the goal is, to colonize places that are inconceivably far.
Yeah, you take a star system. Let's say there was a habitable one we thought 10 light years away. Problem is we're nowhere near being able to build a spaceship that could go approach even the speed of light and take advantage of relativistic effects, which means the time would pass very quickly. Is that it might take us 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years to get something with technology we can conceive of today to there. And so what we would do is we'd build this big, huge spaceship, ship it there slowly, and the idea that, as Brian points, the great-great-grandchildren of the people on board there are going to, you know, arrive at the planet. Or you freeze a bunch of embryos and you have robots raise them or whatever. And both of these, to me, are, you know, these are ideas of the era of Aldous Huxley. This is not how I would do this today.
These are the equivalent of Jules Verne saying, you know, you fire us off to the moon in a cannon.
Well, yeah. It just seems so obsessed with, you know, our own sacrifice and mortality and everything. And it just seems like it is far more a poetic concept, right? That we, the brave, will sacrifice ourselves and literally, you know, the phoenix from our ashes will be our children that will colonize this new world, where it's like, we generally, right? When people want to explore, you know, or at least historically, they kind of want to be the ones that hit land, right? Like, yeah. It just sort of seems like odd that, like, yes, no, we will create these huge machines and we will investigate far-flung worlds to the point where we understand that when we get there, it just won't be a jalopy that we won't be able to colonize. But then we will stop developing when it comes to hypersleep or figuring out a way that life preservation can exist in a manner for which, you know, we will be the ones that get there. It just seems like an odd place where it's like, okay, these things will advance to a certain point, but these other things will not, because that's where the poetry comes in. The poetry is in the sacrifice.
That's the thing, is I think our culture and our genetics will evolve even faster than our ability to throw, you know, metal through space. And by the time we get that ability, our interests and the way we view our place in the universe will be fundamentally different.
Well, and we, when we talk about throwing metal through space, though, too, is that we, you know, we keep imagining these, you know, spaceships like Starship Enterprise and stuff like that, when, you know, if we wanted to build, you know, an accelerator that was going to shoot things the size of an iPod towards star systems, they'll get there a hell of a lot faster. You know, we would within our own lifetime.
Well, and that's the thing is the idea we will sooner be able to figure out how to reconstitute a human body from scratch using nanobots than we will figure out a convenient way to get, you know, faster than 20 G's and keep a human body happy and healthy inside a jelly suspension or whatever.
Exactly.
And also, like, there is some weird, troubling subtext to, like, I decide that I'm going to go colonize a thing and I will bravely sacrifice my life so that can be the case. Now, my sons and daughters, yeah. Oops, sorry, guys, you get to live on a spaceship. But don't worry, your kids will get to colonize a thing that we're pretty sure is pretty rad.
Well, that's a theme that's been used in science fiction, because some writers have stumbled upon the idea, like, yeah, what if you're the kid born on a generation ship? Like, yeah, that's why we're not going to do them, you know?
Well, okay, so real quick, we're getting into spoiler territory for Aurora. So if you have the slightest interest in anything we've talked about, allow me to recommend that you pause and resume later in the program, because in order to talk about Kim Stanley Robinson's idea, we have to talk about plot points in Aurora. Pause now. I highly, highly recommend it. But of course, what you're describing is exactly what happens in Aurora. It's the, you know, seventh or eighth generation, and somebody wakes up and they are the generation that is making it to the planet. And one of the big things they discover, much to their dismay, is that it turns out any planet capable of sustaining human compatible biology has already started the precursors to it. And in doing so, it essentially is made of poison, is what he says. And so, and yes, again, we can project in the future and say, well, if we're, you know, if we do it in some other fantasy, you know, we'll be able to figure it out. But, you know, I could picture a picture a sufficiently advanced and wealthy society that they would try a generation ship. And in the event that we are in one of these scenarios where, you know, 100 or 200 or 300 generation ships have gone out, what happens when you get there and you find out that all of the planets, if they have water, then they have precursors that can infect your body?
I'm just wondering, like, what monsters are sending generation ships to planets that we couldn't send much faster moving probes to before? I just, it's,
I mean, you could reject the entire premise, but within the premise,
I'm just asking what society thinks this is a good idea.
Dude, trust me, a society that is accustomed to government spending. That's the one where it's like you know, like nobody wants probes. People want human boats. See, we're going to send them all out.
I just the idea that before we send this $10 trillion thing there that, well, you know, we can build a probe like we do now, like we do, our NASA does, every program does now. Like, it seems to me like a writer's convenience to sort of say, we could probe it, but we won't because it'll really, I won't be able to tell the story.
As a matter of fact, I could actually buy that defense completely because if you send a probe, you won't get an answer for literally 100 to 200 years. And let's say you're facing a very real major climactic change that could wipe people out, or that you're worried that you're in too small of a petri dish where, you know, all our eggs are in one galactic basket. I can totally see three or four generations of let's go, let's sail to the stars. We can't afford to wait.
I mean, yeah, we can create a situation to me, but it seems to me like absolutely we can't. I just, to me, that it ignores the point that you can build a smaller probe that can go there 10 times faster and give you that information, though. And that's a lot of these things, like, and we didn't know. And like, that's a lot of science fiction thing, is we don't know until we showed up. And I'm like, well, you know, you can make a really small probe that can get there a lot faster. And it's like, as a writer trying to avoid the use of cell phones, because you're like, well, yeah, that'll ruin my plot if they have a cell phone too convenient.
How big is the generation ship in Aurora? Like, how many people?
Jeepers. I want to say like maybe 2,000. No, wait, maybe 30,000. I remember thinking it was like a small town.
Because, like, I can buy it as, like, you know, one, like a family, right? Or like a block, or like some, like, you know, doomsday prepper, you know, kind of like, you know, in a world in which this is slightly cheaper, right? Or it is something that, like, can be done yet isn't done because of moral obligations. Like, I can definitely buy the idea that somebody would want to do it, right? I don't know the idea of it being a, like, governmental or political, like we need to marshal our resources and we need to spend on this big one thing, like, I think is problematic.
Well, the book doesn't go into any of that, you know, because it's already over with.
I'm not talking about the book necessarily, but just in general, the idea of generation ships, like, as a concept, like, I think it's to echo what Andrew was saying earlier, like, it just very much seems like, like, it bears the hallmarks of kind of where we were thinking 30 years ago, you know?
I think that might be the point of it, because it's the book is really an indictment of the past 30 years of science fiction, including his own books. You know, he spends, you know, a half chapter explaining why all his own seminal work, the Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars trilogy, is not possible, and breaks it all down. And I think that's what he was going for with Aurora, where he wants to shut down this other trope of science fiction that we've had for so long.
Interesting.
In his face.
Well, yeah. And again, I don't think he's saying we have a pressing problem in that too many people are trying to build an ark today. Similar to one of my favorite Star Wars books was this moment. I think it was one of the second Timothy Zahn books, where there was two books back to back, and there's this conversation where Mara Jade is talking to Luke Skywalker, and she's just going off for half a chapter about how irresponsibly he's been using the Force and how, you know, you can't do that and blah, blah, blah. And about halfway through, I realized that this is not Mara Jade talking to Luke Skywalker. This is Timothy Zahn talking to all the other authors of Star Wars books who have Luke Skywalker using his Force as a catch-all deus ex machina for everything. So that's the way I would read all this with Kim Stanley Robinson.
Well, boys and girls, listeners of all ages, if you want to see humanity survive, we believe that probably becoming a multi-planet, multi-environment species, let's be honest, we live on asteroids, is imperative to do that. In order for that to happen, you need the sober voices of reason and us telling you why we need to move towards this.
And if not us, then at least artificially intelligent agents that are exactly like us. And guess what? Those don't come cheap. We have a rainy day fund. We're hiring programmers, futurologists. We're going to hire Kim Stanley Robinson to tell us why it can't be done. And we need your cash is what we're saying.
By hiring, we're moving up our invisible board of priorities. They're not lowering, they're hiring. Eventually we'll spend money on it. But right now we are raising that war chest at patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah, man. Dude, this show, I don't know about you guys, but we're coming up on what, almost a year since we started taking money for it? I think the show's gotten a hell of a lot better. Certainly has gotten a hell of a lot more regular and almost on time.
Absolutely. You know, I'm super excited by everything that we've been able to do thanks to everybody's support. So thank you again, everybody. If you like the show, hit us up, patreon.com/weirdthings.
So I want to take you back in time to, I don't know, when did we work on the G-Force show?
Just geez, 2008. Because I remember G4 Underground came out. It must have been. Because I met Justin in 2008, and then I started doing BB Live Show in 2009, and that was in those early days. I remember Justin was plugging G4 Underground.
So we did a series with my producing partner, Mary Jarris. I co-executive produced and created a show, a series of documentaries, and Justin came in and worked with us on this as an associate producer, and it was a bunch of documentaries, mini docs on cool tech stuff, things like that. We had Silicon Valley fight clubs where guys would bash each other over the heads with keyboards. We did things on, the burgeoning, online independent porn and people using, stimulants and all that for doing competition gaming, et cetera, and all that. I went to G4 with like a list of topics that I wanted to talk. G4, by the way, for some of your listeners going, what's that? Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore.
There used to be this network called Tech TV. There's this other entity called Comcast. It's a whole big thing.
Yeah, anyhow. I went with him with a list of topics, and I had one subject that I said, this is really what, I think we should talk about. So, would you like to talk about Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs became big? I'm like, well, yeah. I said, well, I've got the guy to talk about. We should do a profile on this guy because he's got his hands in everything.
Oh, my gosh. Like, is this who I think it is? Back in 2009?
They're like, who? I'm like, no, really. And I got Mary. Mary was on board with this. We're like, yeah. She's like, oh, yeah, he'd be great. I'm like, yeah, this guy's like Tony Stark. This guy's amazing. We should do this. G4's like, we don't really think it's that much coverage. And that, of course, was Elon Musk.
Wow.
I tried my
just so
damnedest.
Y'all know how OG we are about our yeah. Elon fanboyism.
Yeah, it was we tried very, very, very hard to get them on that, but they didn't really see him as being the figure that he is. And flash forward later, the guy actually was in an Iron Man movie. And this week was kind of a big deal because we had a couple things. One, it looks like SpaceX is gonna be the only bidder for this Air Force contract. Two, NASA just gave them the official contract to ferry astronauts in 2017 to the International Space Station.
Holy cow, that's huge.
Yes, there is actually NASA has bought tickets on board a SpaceX rocket, as well as Boeing's project, the Boeing Starcraft, forget what it's called. So we don't know who will be first, but we have the exciting part is that there are two private companies that within a 2 years frame of time plan to send astronauts to the International Space Station. That is an exciting time. But more important is that Elon Musk reached this cultural breakthrough because he was on an episode of Big Bang Theory.
Oh, that means my parents might know who Elon Musk is finally. Did he appear as himself?
Yes. So the we don't have the audio. Do we have the audio? Do you want to play the audio?
Yeah.
Was that an orgasm joke?
Yes.
What are you doing here?
I'm washing dishes.
Well, I'm in a food kitchen in a homeless shelter.
But I got demoted for being too generous with the gravy.
Oh, man. What an honor to meet you. I'm such a fan of Tesla and SpaceX, all your companies. Howard Wolowitz, Caltech.
Nice to meet you, Howard. It feels great to come down here and help the less fortunate, huh?
Oh, yeah. Nothing better than helping people. Which is something I realized when I was viewing Earth from the deck of the International Space Station, where I spent 2 months as a payload specialist, a job I was qualified for because I'm an MIT-trained engineer.
And I thought I ladled the graveyard deck.
Anyhow, we don't have to go all the way through.
Yeah, I was about to say, we were just going to watch the episode.
But, I mean, that's the point we're going where, you know, 20 years ago, hey, this guy wants us to go to Mars. That's great. Tell me what kind of medications he's on. See if we need to up it, you know, because he's a private guy. He's going to, you know, help us find to be.
So, I mean, yeah, if I remember correctly, one of the original pitches for G4 Underground was about the private space race. And it was going to focus on Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos. And basically the idea that like, oh, look, because even part of that initial premise, even from us, was like, look at these guys. They're doing this stuff. Like, you know, maybe it'll work out. Maybe it won't. But the story here is that the money being spent by these people as an investment for this kind of advancement. And now it's like it's a punchline. I mean, like, you know, Big Bang Theory and CBS in general, that their style of comedy is based on the idea that you know these people, and therefore when they show up, it's funny that they're acting against character, right? So Elon Musk, the guy who you know, states plainly, he wants to die on Mars, is the humble guy in the food kitchen who's like, doesn't it feel great, you know, to just be a normal guy and give back? Like, that there's this, like, oh, wow, he's taking time away from these grand things to look at this small thing. That's part of the comedy. It's insane how far we've come, you know, that before it was like, yeah, I don't know, fringe stuff. People won't get it on a hip, young, a science and tech leaning network. Like, oh, I don't know, people will understand it, which goes in to tell you how much the people that ran that network knew their audience. But is now like, yeah, it's mainstream. It is people are laughing about it at 8 p.m. on Monday.
So when Elon Musk is a double curious character, because, you know, the longer he continues to work his progress in his projects, the more we track all of his successes. And there is no shortage of them. Some of the most revolutionary successes in technology and business development and increasing the quality of life for humanity in my lifetime are responsible by Elon Musk. But I wonder, I would love to spend some time, and I'm not saying now has to be that time, but I would love to hear about his failures, because, I mean, he's a dude and he makes bets, and bets don't always come up, you know, winners. And granted, he wins a lot, which is why he's a very, very wealthy dude, and his wins are important to all of humanity. But I don't know. I would love to get a little more humanization and hear, but I would love to hear what ideas just didn't pan out, you know?
Well, he's, you know, he talks a bit about that, you know, about where what they thought would work and what wouldn't work. And, you know, you look at the struggles of Tesla and how that company almost didn't survive. And in the middle of that struggle, he's borrowing money from friends to keep going because he's got everything bet on that. And SpaceX, you know, they lost a rocket this summer. If they'd lost that rocket earlier on after they had like three other blowups when they're testing their rocket engines, there would be no SpaceX. And the conversation about space right now would be very, very, very different. You know, there's the book by Ashley Vance, which I have not read yet, which goes into a big biography of Elon Musk. You know, supposed to go into a lot of that. And, you know, the we see stuff like that, you know, that they're trying to pull off another rocket launch this December and hope that it works, because if that explodes, I think SpaceX will survive, but it'll be a very tarnished image that'll take a while to recover from.
Well, and I think part of it is, you know, for people who have followed, you know, Elon Musk for a long time, there have been a ton of failures within that success, right? And if there's anything that makes him a strong, you know, leader, you know, if you want to give him credit, part of it is he has understood where to cut bait and where to reinvest, and he has reinvested aggressively. And there's elements, you know, when you compare an Elon Musk to a Steve Jobs, that's kind of where I think in you know, the second Apple stint for Steve Jobs, that he was really smart about was, you know, understanding what was working, what was not working, and betting heavily on the stuff that worked. You know, if you know, there's one of the great books. Maybe this will be my pick, but the perfect thing about the creation of the iPod, you know, it was part of what ascended Tim Cook from, you know, amongst the other executives to kind of one of the big executives was his sourcing of parts and the fact that like they bet gigantic on the iPod because they didn't want it to, they wanted to be able to sell a lot of them. And it, that's what made Apple and the iPod go from like, you know, Apple became far more than just a computer manufacturer in a very short amount of time because they bet so heavily, and yet not as heavily on some other verticals that didn't wind up panning out, and probably not as big on stuff like web development, which they're still bad at.
I have one more topic. We brought up earlier the discussion of like who would try to do generation shifts or whatever, and I explained why I thought it was just an absurd idea, etc. You know, who would try to embark upon that kind of social engineering? Don't have an answer to that, but I do have an article, by the way, that's a totally different segue. China, social credit. Beijing sets up huge system. I don't know if you've been following this, but this is from the BBC. This is sort of kind of a news everywhere. In most countries, the existence of a credit system isn't controversial. Past financial information is used to predict whether individuals will pay their mortgages or a credit card bill in the future. But China is taking the whole concept a few steps further. The Chinese government is building an omnipotent social credit system that is meant to rate each citizen's trustworthiness. And what is it, omnipotent, or did they mean omniscient? Either way, by 2020,
it can actually do anything. levitate things.
Yeah, they said, you know, omnipotent, but I think they may have been. But anyway, by 2020, everyone in China will be enrolled in a vast national database that will compile fiscal and government information, including minor traffic violations, and distills it into a single number ranking each citizen. So this could encompass everything from, you know, one, your credit ratings, whatever. They already have systems in place that Alibaba has called like Sesame, where if you have a high enough rating, you don't need to put down a deposit when you rent a car. But this is also a system that will incorporate, what are you saying on social media? What is your trustworthiness? How are you, you know, there's this concept in China of harmony. You know, are you helping with harmony? Or are you disrupting harmony?
Man, and I am all over the map in my visceral reaction to this, because on the one hand, I absolutely loathe the fact that this is a government entity deciding to put a permanent brand on someone on their trustworthiness. I mean, what business is it of is theirs? However, you know,
Brian, explain your hesitation about it as John Stossel.
I'm saving that for Tuesday night. But on the flip side, having dealt with Alibaba, that's real useful to have a reputation score for all those guys. When you hop on the chat when you know that there are companies that will do things like a friend of mine had an electronic gizmo that he asked, you know, is it possible to get this made in black? And the text came back, you're like, yeah, no, here, look, we'll whip one up. And the very next day, hours later, they show him a working model of it and it's in black. He's like, well, hell yeah, I'll take 1,000 of them. He gets them, they just spray paint them all. They're all white plastic, just spray painted black, and it looks good enough.
Brian, that's a great point of why, and that's one of the arguments being made is for dealing with trading. China's got over 1 billion people. How do you trust people within there? And so that's the pro argument, is that when it's particularly an economic system like that, the question goes into what happens when the entity controlling it's the government and it's the Communist Party, and they get to affect your score because, you know, you said some things, you know, on social media about the traffic, and we've been doing our best to try to fix that, and we don't think that was very helpful.
Yeah. What's the what was the religious group that they tried to scrub off the internet? Falun Gong or something like that?
Yeah, Falun Gong, yeah.
This brings me to the second part. So let's picture another version where it's like there's two or three competing entities, and yet here in the United States, not using the government – that startup people tried to create essentially the same thing, and they were crushed. They were pilloried in the court of public PEEPLE.
Which also we don't know how close to vaporware that really was.
But we do know that the idea of it was resoundingly rejected by the populace. It was pitched as Yelp for people, basically.
Well, but that gets into Yelp. I don't think there should be a Yelp for people. I think Yelp is great, but if that becomes into this, you know, the potential we see already the potential harm, you know, that Yelp has is a great value, but is also going to be very damaging. You see somebody who says something unpopular and you watch their Yelp rating plummet because of people who never went there don't like this person. When you imagine what would happen to the Yelp for people and how it sounds to me horrible.
Now,
horrible.
So, all right, can I make and not to be Alex Jones, but let me make this slippery slope argument of like, okay, so now we have a government repository wherein we keep, all right. Well, congratulations, you are high enough in reputation, you can travel back and forth to the United States as much as you want. We are not going to worry about that. You are a good representation of Chinese culture. The lower ones, once you start having what is universally thought of as a quantitative score of a human being, then, and this is where I'm making the logical leap, what do we do with these people? Should we be punishing them? Should we be
charging more for them? Or
yeah, should they have to pay more for some of these permits? Is there a way that we can rehabilitate them? Or, and now I'm making another leap in logic, is this something where maybe it'd be better if they don't exist anymore? You know, maybe.
Jesus. Type
in Hong Kong bookstore into Google News and see what happens.
Okay. And in the meantime, let's say a less extreme jump is not that we're going to murder them, but you know, there was a time when without irony, you know, during the eugenics movement, we would sterilize people of lower races, as they were called.
In Hong Kong, a publisher of books that were critical of the Chinese powers, of influential politicians, the people running the store, they vanished.
Okay. Do we think they were actually taken to prison or what?
Yes, Brian.
Well,
yes.
No. I mean, it could very well be just like, hey, shut down your business, go find another job, and they could have been pressured into that. It's not, but I guess that's true. That's possible too. So I'm not going to say, you know, whether it's good or bad or what the solution is, but I will say here's why I think this is inevitable. Is it all comes down to Dunbar's number? I think that we are built to want to. We have outgrown our capacity to grasp other people's reputations. We can't keep track of more than 150, 250 people. And so as a result, we all need that cybernetic augmentation that allows us to make a snap judgment about someone so we don't waste our time.
I mean, a question is, do we have it already? You know, I just bought this Lumix camera, which I'm not broadcasting with, but I will be soon as I get the AC charger, off eBay. So there was the camera that I needed on eBay. I have no idea who this person is. However, I've seen that they have a long list of successful transactions with a lot of people saying very nice things about how professionally they handled everything. And there, based on a online gathered metric, in a moment of need, I was given assurances to make that deal and PayPal over money before. But without having seen this person, I'll never see this person in my life, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is it happening? And now the question is, do we need it better? Do we need it more central? Do we need a combination? Did I need to know how this person has yelled and screamed about politics on Twitter? Do I need to have the fact that he's gotten a bunch of parking tickets, you know, or should he think twice about accepting the money from me because I've gotten maybe 3 dozen parking tickets in the last 3 years of traveling around the country? Like, Should that be factored in? Does that make us smarter or dumber?
I mean, that's the big question, right? Because what if I told you that, hey, we pulled a criminal report on this guy, and he's a rapist and might have been involved in a drunk driving manslaughter. Would that affect your decision to buy a camera from him?
Likely. If I look two different cameras, I would probably say, well, what about this other guy? It's like, oh, no, he's a Sunday school teacher, and he just had a successful first date with another school teacher. I would be like, oh, okay, well, he seems like somebody that I want to buy the camera from. Now, maybe that other dude is a creep. I mean, I guess the part of what makes what I think one of the defining challenges of our age is – Now we are in the infinitely calculatable society. Everything's recorded. Everything, you know, has an ability for us to look at it. And one of the greatest frustrations in my life are people who believe that all numbers are good numbers. And that by looking at certain things and focusing on certain pieces of data, that makes them smarter. When ultimately, I very much believe that it can very easily make us dumber. Like that generations from now, we will not just think it's like, oh, well, here's a number. I found a number. That's a great number. I'm going to make decisions based on that number. It's like,
well,
no.
Well, the problem is, as more stuff is recorded, it becomes increasingly easy and possible to turn anyone into a caricature. And we're already seeing that in some of the political debates that we see. It's all you have to do.
That's always happened.
Well, I know. But again, yes, it's always happened. But we haven't had thousands of speeches available on call and algorithms that are able to look for racially divisive combinations of words that could be taken out of context in order to portray someone as this. And in fact, you know, I've talked about this before. I'm waiting for the day when engines crawl through public crowd shots, and then, you know, so that 20 years from now, a presidential candidate, some robot's going to spot him in the background of a Occupy Wall Street rally, and it's going to come up, and he won't be able to deny that he was there because the facial recognition was able to break it down and see it. So it's like it's already happening. We're just waiting for the technology to catch up with the point where it could be thrown in our faces.
I think, you know, I'm all for reputation systems within specific systems. And what the question we had, you know, 15 years ago with the rise of Amazon and eBay was, as they were based on reviews, was this, well, how do we know they're not going to be gamed? Well, of course they're going to be gamed. Of course people are going to try to do that. And what became incumbent upon or beholden upon Amazon and eBay was to say, yeah, you know what our job is? Our job is to make sure that they're, you know, to minimize how much they're being gamed, because we're really selling on reputation. That's what we're selling on. And they had an accountability thing, because once we didn't trust them, we would go elsewhere. When it's the government doing that, guess what happens when they leak, you know, like, you know, my brother's a federal employee. Guess what? They leaked all of the contact information from everybody that he contacted with, all my information, everything. All that got out because somebody didn't care, and somebody's responsibility, you know, to make this secure, they didn't do it. There's no repercussion. The people that did this, we don't know who the people were who were stupid about how they maintain these records. They're never going to find fault or blame. Every time something like that happens to a company, there's a reputational cost. You know, we see that all the time. Like credit cards get leaked, things like that. That becomes problematic and scary. And that's the scariest thing to me. It's one thing. You know, we found that, yeah, companies care a lot on doing this. Not that I trust them. I don't trust Facebook. I don't trust Amazon. I don't trust any of them. I trust them to do what they do.
Yeah, you trust them to look out for their own interests and to recognize that it's damaging if they get a bad reputation.
Exactly. And so we've seen how these systems have evolved very, very quickly and become very, very good. You know, Amazon, like I tell people, like, hey, if you like something I do, you know, say something nice on Amazon. I won't tell people how to review it or what to say, because Amazon's got spiders crawling through the webs trying to see who you know, who your friends are. And if they see that a bunch of reviews belong to email addresses that are all on the same list of your family members on some family picnic thing or whatever like that, you know, for all I know, like I've heard stories, I'm like, yeah, they'll say, sorry, we're not counting these and stuff, because that's how much they're investing in it. But
well, and understand, like, they are fighting against moneyed interests. There are people that will, under the table, promise, you know, hey, pay us $10,000. We're going to buy a whole bunch of copies of your book. Don't worry. We have a network of stooges, you know, across the nation that we've identified which bookstores they count and so on. I mean, that's straight up gaming. And that does harm, you know, the New York Times bestseller list as when they become victims of it.
You know, but on the other side of it, you have, you know, the Europe idea of the right to be forgotten, you know, which is this, you know, law they passed, which says that, you know, you have this right to ask Google not to link to articles or things like that that are critical of you after a certain period of time, which to me is just, that's the opposite of free speech. You know, that to me is, that's a scary idea. I'm against the idea of some central repository for, like, you know, the government, you know, giving you some sort of arbitrary rating, which, you know, I don't care who you're voting for. You don't want them having power over that.
Well, and keep in mind, like, all of America, you know, everyone who lives here is the descendant, except for one group who owned it before they got given poison blankets. But all of us come from a generation of dissidents.
Didn't happen.
Oh, really? That didn't happen? Wait, is that fake, the smallpox blankets thing?
Yeah, it was somebody said we should try this, but there's no.
All right. Regardless, what I'm saying is, unless you're Native American, you are here because you had dissidents in your family lineage. You had contrarian blood in you. And so as a result, like in England, culturally, it's the definition of libel is like, if you can't prove it's true, you can't say it. Whereas in America, it's like, you got to prove me a liar. You know, the reverse. The burden of proof is completely flipped upside down.
Yeah. So there you have it, guys.
You want to do picks?
Yes, picks. Yes.
Can I go first?
Yeah, go.
Yeah, go.
All right. I've got a pick for y'all. It's an unconventional pick. May not be realistic, but I don't care.
What?
I don't care what you're doing right now.
Okay.
I don't care what your job is, what your family obligations are, whatever they are. What you need to do is you need to get into a car or get in an airplane and you need to fly to Disneyland and go to Season of the Force. What is this? It is a celebration of Star Wars at Disneyland. Now, what does this mean? You know, I heard, like, yeah, they're doing Season of the Force. You know, their innovations begin to have some, like, you know, maybe they're going to have some cool stuff there at, you know, character meets or whatever like that. I'm like, all right, let me go check this out. I went by myself, finished writing, sitting here saying, you know what? I got a Disney pass. Why don't I go to Disneyland, see what it's about? What happened? Oh, I don't know. I met Chewbacca. All right. I got a photo with me and Chewbacca chilling out, right? And you're like, oh, what else is cool about that? Like, here, for all of our video listeners.
Proof. Pixar didn't happen.
I'm with Chewbacca right there. And let me tell you what, and then I'm with Darth Vader. Meeting Chewbacca, my buddy Adam Franklin put it best. He says, like, you go meet Chewbacca, he puts his arm around you and hugs you. And for that moment, you both forget you're grown men.
That's amazing.
I was like, the guy who played Chewbacca was amazing. He was just like, you know, puts his arm around me. It was like a Wookiee. I got hugged by a Wookiee. Don't tell me it was some guy in a mask. It wasn't.
How did he do the sound effects? Was it like electronically recorded with
No, he didn't actually make any noise.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, but Chewbacca, but he's just the guy, the manners are perfect. He puts his arm, I'm like, it's Chewbacca, I'm being, you know, hugged by Chewbacca. It was a great moment. And then I'm like, you know what, Darth Vader's over there, why don't I go say hello to Darth Vader? I go through the line, I walk down there, and now all of a sudden, like, Chewbacca, you met him on Yavin, it was like the temple on Yavin. Darth Vader's in this Imperial base, you walk down the corridor, all the Disney employees are dressed like members of the Empire, and there's Darth Vader, right? And I walk in there, and I'm looking for you. Hand the guy the camera. Hand the, you know, the attendant's my camera, and there's like this voice, Darth Vader voice, is saying something. I'm not really paying attention. I'm handing this person my camera, and then I'm kind of like mugging for a photo. And one of the Disney people says, "Lord Vader is addressing you." oh! And I turn, and Darth Vader says to me, "says Your path to the dark side is almost complete, but your training still needs to be continued." And he's telling me about turning to the dark side and what I need to do. And it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then it's, you know, time to do the pose. And that's what he has you do. You're doing the, you know, the force pose right there. So
that's amazing.
So I met that. And then you're like, what else is there? All right. You like Space Mountain? Do you guys like Space Mountain?
Sure.
Okay. Imagine when you were first time you're in Space Mountain, you ever pretend you're in an X-Wing on Space Mountain?
Sure.
Imagine I'm an American. If you didn't have to make believe anymore.
What? Right?
So it's called, it's no longer Space Mountain right now. It's Hyperspace Mountain, right? You walk in there, you go through the line, there's Star Wars music, there's Star Wars music playing all over Tomorrowland. But when you get onto Hyperspace Mountain, you know the video, like, hey, here's how you need to ride this ride. It's Admiral Akbar explaining to you what you need to do. You go through the line, then you come into the big bay where you're loading. There's a big X photos like an X-Wing on the video monitor. You're part of an X-Wing squadron about to go on a raid or over the planet of Jakku against the Empire. You go through that hyperspace jump. The tunnel is now hyperspace drooming at you. TIE fighters, you know, fly overhead. They've got video projections. So they've taken this classic dark ride and they add tons of video projection and music and these laser effects. So, like, you're flying along and all of a sudden you see lasers are going pew, 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 pew all around you. And it's kind of, like, really awesome.
That is fantastic. In fact, actually, I'm going to take your enthusiasm and roll straight into my pick. It's a flawed pick. It doesn't do nearly as much as it should for the price that it is, but I've had more fun than I could count playing with my 11-year-old daughter Star Wars Battlefront. It's it only is, you know, online. You got a little bit of offline stuff. There is no story. It's just, you know, run around and fight on Endor, run around and fight on Hoth, run around and fight on, you know, every place. But the fact is, you're running around and fighting on those places. When you're running on Hoth, you hear the snow crunching beneath your feet, and it is the perfect, you know, the clear blue sky on this crystal, you know, cold Norwegian day. And it's so awesome when you're in the middle of a dogfight air battle, and then it just a little notification comes up saying Slave One has just appeared, and you realize that your team or the rebels are in trouble. It's great, man. It was so much fun watching my 11-year-old walking around murdering rebels as Darth Vader in the training exercises.
So, yeah, it's gotten kind of beat up review-wise because it doesn't have much of a solo story to it and is essentially a multiplayer game where you have to, you know, really, really grind out what has been described as kind of boring missions to get better power-ups for your multiplayer. But you're saying worth it.
Oh my God! Yes. If you have the means, I highly recommend it. Look. Don't expect more than a fantastic 20 hours before you get bored of it. But think about it, man. You know, $60 is less than you'd spend to actually go to Disneyland, and I'm going to say it brings you 70-80% of the adventure. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
What was it like when Chewbacca hugged you, Brian?
Okay. I said 70%.
Oh.
I would like to last minute do a couple plugs because it's really what I am. I don't know if you know this, but my book How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, it's been like the number one book on writing on Amazon for like the last week.
Yeah.
Sometimes it dips down to number two or three, but mostly it's been number one.
Congratulations.
Kind of stoked about. And I got a new magic book out, by the way. You can pre-order called Magic and Mischief if you go to andrewmain.com and click on store. You'll find the link through there. But that's not all. We've got a special treat for you listeners here. Mr. Justin Robert Young recorded the first chapter of my novella, Game Night, which we're going to play right as soon as I say it's been weird.
This is an excerpt from Game Night, a novella by Andrew Main. Buy it now at Amazon by searching GAMEKNIGHT or find it where all other Andrew Main books reside. The sword in the forest. It's a dream. I mean, it's night out, so it's gotta be a damn dream. I keep telling myself this, but it doesn't make the man in the armor stop trying to slam his heavy effing axe mallet thing into my head. Wait! Wait! I hold out my hand to make him stop. He lets out a yell and swings at my forearm. I yank it back, but not fast enough to avoid getting grazed. Clang! My arm rattles like a mother. That's when I see the metal plate wrapped around it. Holy shit. I'm in armor too. I scream, "Stop! Time out!" He just keeps coming. I back up. My ass bumps against a tree trunk, and I get the hell out of the way as the psycho brings his warhammer high above his head to pound me into the ground like a tent stake. Jesus! I trip over a root and fall down. The sword. The damn sword I saw stuck in the tree stump when I woke up, fell asleep. It's still there, calling me to some adventure I don't want. The psycho with the mallet stands over me. Jesus, he's tall. Like some freaking Indiana farm boy basketball player tall. His armor is chainmail, covered with some dirty rag thing hanging over his body and a rusty metal helmet on his head. I don't stop to make my case. I just back the hell up again while he takes another wild swing at me. I'm getting tired. I don't remember feeling this way in a dream before. Maybe I'm high, only I don't get high. Crap. What if this is encephalitis and I'm trapped in some Jacob's Ladder gurney pissing myself? Damn it. When I come to, I could have brain damage and be like one of those poor sons of bitches who can't remember more than a minute at a time. Bam! He misses my head and smashes a tree, sending bark everywhere. Jesus. Are those spikes on the end of the hammer? I know one thing. If this ain't a dream and this asshole hits me, there's no way I live without brain damage. Fine! I'll get the damn sword! Oblivious, he takes two quick strides and is almost on top of me, raising the hammer again. I try to kick him in the chest, like I know Gymkata or some BS, and end up hitting him in the thigh. It's enough to make him fall backwards. Maybe under the armor, he's not as solid as he looks. I run over to the stump and grab a handle of the sword. It's wedged in tight. Thanks a lot. Sir Asshole has regained his balance and is running toward me. Wait, let me get this thing free, I shout, hoping this is part of his game. Evidently, it's not in his rulebook. He swipes at me again, this time swinging the mallet like he's Ty Cobb swinging for the fences. I can feel the wind on my neck as the edge of the hammer breezes by, almost knocking my Adam's apple out of my throat. When I pull back, the sword comes free and topples with me over the trunk and into a muddy ditch. I grip the handle and scramble out while Sir Asshole stands astride the stump, hammer held up in the air like he's a psychotic Thor, and he prepares to jump. Hell no. I claw my way out of the tough and make it to the other side. He pauses, not sure if he should leap or walk around. I take off running, leaving him to his decision. That's when I hear the sound of dogs barking. Not playful, come tickle us barking. These are snarling, growling hounds on the hunt for something. If I want help, that is not the direction to run. I go the opposite way, slashing and stumbling my way through the brush in the darkness. I realize part of the reason my head feels funny and I'm having difficulty seeing is because of the damn helmet on my head. I consider taking it off and then hear the sound of Sir Asshole stomping through the forest behind me. I realize that temporary limited visibility is much better than permanent blindness. There's something of a path beyond the clump of bushes. I make my way to it, keeping a watch over my shoulder for my attacker. I'm beginning to think this isn't a dream. Sure, the last thing I remember was falling asleep on my couch, but how many rape victims have similar memories? I mean, not on my couch, but waking up somewhere unfamiliar. Of course, I was all alone. What if Sir Asshole drugged me? Maybe he's some kind of serial killer who snatches people out of their homes and brings them out to the woods so he can smash their brains in. And dresses them in armor?
Is that any weirder than making girls suits out of dead hookers? Jesus. I don't know. If I did, then I guess I'd be working at the FBI tracking down these jerk-offs. Jingle, jingle, jingle. Like a meth-crazed, anorexic Santa Claus, Sir Asshole is stomping his way toward me. I wheel around and hold my sword as if he's going to voluntarily skewer himself. Is anybody there? A woman cries somewhere in the distance. Run away! I shout at the top of my lungs. Sir Asshole is still sprinting toward me with his warhammer propped up on one shoulder, ready to strike me down. Stay back! I scream, my sword wavering in my hand. I want to run, but my body just can't anymore. Come on, man! Stay the hell away! He doesn't give a damn. He shouts, scared, confused, too stupid to know what else to do. I lunge at him. My sword point punctures his ringmail and slides between his ribs. The man's momentum pushes it all the way through. For the first time, I see his eyes behind the visor. Scared eyes. Confused. The hammer slips from his limp fingers and hits the ground with a thud. The man collapses, falling backwards, his hand trying to stem the flow of blood gushing from his body. Shit. Damn. Shit. He gasps. I lean over him. Let me help you. A bloody hand grabs my throat and starts choking me. Christ's sake! I yank myself free. His hand falls to his side, and he stops moving.
Is anybody there?
Calls the distant voice. I run to her, dragging the sword behind me, not sure what the hell I'm supposed to do with it. When I find her, she's bound to a tree with her chained hands pulling above her head. Dark hair, early 20s, and pretty if she weren't so terrified. A thin white gown sticks to the sweat of her body. She looks like one of those women in distress on the cover of a fantasy novel, as some muscled barbarian protects her. Only she's got me, a graphic designer who puked after his first session of CrossFit and never came back.
Don't hurt me,
she pleads, trying to pull herself away. I won't.
Is this a dream?
She asks me. I don't know. If it is, then it's mine and it's messed up. She pulls at her wrists.
Do you have the key? The man said it would be around the knight's neck.
The man? I touch my neck. There's nothing there. Christ, stay here, I say stupidly, and then run back to the dead knight. I'm half afraid he'll be gone when I get there, but not all relieved when I find out that he isn't. Are you okay? I ask the body, nervous to get any closer. The man doesn't move. I squat down and feel for a pulse under his neck, just like they taught me in office safety. Nothing. I feel a thick cord and pull at it. There's a key on the other end, but to get it off his head, I have to take off his helmet. Even though Sir Asshole is dead, I'm still afraid to remove it. 1,000 horror movies have conditioned me to believe that the monster isn't dead when you think it is.
Are you still there?
The girl calls out.
Just a second.
Somewhere in the distance, the dogs bark. Hell's bells, when do I wake up? I yank the helmet free and see the man for the first time. He's old. An unkempt gray beard sits on a gaunt, tired face. He looks unwell. Well, no shit, he's dead. But other than that, he's got the color of somebody who's been sick, either from drugs or disease, or both. And I killed him.
Please, don't leave me,
the girl cries out. I pull the necklace with my key free and then run back to her.
You came back, she says, relieved. Tears are streaming down her face. Some guy grabbed me and pulled me into a van. He's dead, I reply, and I reach up to undo the lock restraining her. Thank you. Thank you, she rubs her wrists. I thought you were him. I remember my helmet, and I take it off. If I thought this would put her at ease, I was mistaken. Her face goes pale as she lets out an ear-piercing scream. Wait! She slaps me across the face, clawing my skin, and then takes off running. Wait! I shout after her. Not burdened by armor and energized by some level of terror, I can't imagine, she vanishes into the trees. You're welcome, lady. I pick up the sword and walk, not run, in the direction she went, praying she'll come to her senses or I'll wake up. Half an hour later, she's nowhere to be seen, and I'm still here. Except I can see beyond the trees to a road and overhead streetlights illuminating some abandoned industrial area. I reach the middle of the street and look for the girl in either direction. She's long gone. Helmet in one hand, sword in the other. I walk along the shoulder of the road, trying to figure out where I am and what the hell just happened. And that's when the blue lights of an unmarked police car flash behind me. I take it in stride. Of course. Why the hell not? This has been an excerpt from Game Night, the new novella by Andrew Main. Head to Amazon and pick it up right now. GameKnight. Also, make sure you visit AndrewMain.com for all the latest from Andrew Main's writing. My name is Justin Robert Young. The music was from Kevin MacLeod.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.